Okay, so I'm going to be talking about how my research has sort of moved into this field over the last 4 years now. So originally I did a PhD in typical infant social cognition, and I was using a technique called FNIRS, or near infrared spectroscopy, to start looking at brain development in very young infants. So my sort of PhD bridged medical physics and engineering and neuroscience and psychology, and trying to integrate the two of these. And as this technique has got better and better and easier to use with infants, it's now sort of being used as a new focus in understanding how we can bring this technology into the field of studying infants at risk for compromised development, and not just typical development. So as a community, we recognise the need to be identifying early causal factors, developing early detection and intervention strategies, and also a key thing is often behavioural symptoms of disorders don't really manifest themselves to a degree that we're able to clinically diagnose them until toddlers around 2 to 3 years of age. And so by using neuroimaging, it offers a window into the first year of life when we can't see these behavioural responses. And my work has focused on two areas of developmental risk over the last 5 or 6 years. The impact of environmental factors, such as poverty and nutrition, and developmental disorders such as autism and ADHD. So I'm going to be focusing on the project about environment and taking this into a new place, as Vicky's described. So if we consider early life risk factors that you may see in low and middle income countries, we know that nutrition research suggests that risk factors in early infancy have a deep impact on cognitive development, academic achievement and mental health throughout the lifespan, yet almost nothing is known at all about the neural basis of these early deficits. So when I entered the field, I thought I would just look at adult models and think what to do in infancy. Actually, brain development in regard to nutrition is really understudied in general. And so what we do know from recent meta-analysis is that 1 in 3 preschool children in low and middle income countries fail to reach developmental milestones. And the largest number of children affected by these are in sub-Saharan Africa, where our work takes place. And what's very important as well is that there have been numerous attempts to intervene with both nutrition-specific and nutrition-sensitive measures, which might mean the difference between only giving iron, or only giving a particular micronutrient, or giving them lots and lots of nutrients as a global sort of attempt. But really, the global health community has had limited success to date with this. And interventions that do have a greater impact are those that manage to get to infants prior to the first 2 years of life, compared to if you look at studies that have given nutritional supplementation between 2 and 5 years. You know, there are numerous reasons we could talk about over today about why this is difficult. One of them, for example, is the fact, as you see in that middle picture, these are the kind of communities when they often eat from a communal bowl. And so if you try and supplement a mother's diet when she's pregnant, she's going to give it to everybody else. The mother is obviously going to give that food to her children and her husband before she gives it to herself, even if she's being told that it's important for the baby as well. So those kind of challenges exist in even knowing whether they've taken that supplementation or not. Our question here really when we first began was, can neuroimaging be used to inform about early markers of atypical brain development that vary as a function of this early adversity? And can we help inform intervention strategies in these sites? So we were contacted by a group in the Gambia, and that's how I first got involved in this. They are an MRC centre that's been in the middle of rural district since 1948 and have kind of transitioned into mostly studying nutrition. So they've looked at HIV and vaccinations and malaria, but actually Gambia is quite low for HIV now, and it's shifted towards, I mean, it always has been, but it's really a big focus on undernutrition. So a lot of the long-term studies and data that anyone sees is coming from this site, because they've followed some adults now for 40 or 50 years, and they've been looking at seasonality changes and you know, are very experienced in this. So for anyone that doesn't know, the Gambia is this tiny sliver of a country on the West African coast, kind of sandwiched by Senegal. So it's a very small country. It's just around the river.
And the site has this malnutrition centre where parents can come and get free medical care. And so there's a clinic there the whole time for people to use as well. And actually the first baby that we had in our study had walked with their mother for 2 days from Senegal to get free health checks. So it's not something you get in the region. So that's something that does exist for anybody that needs it there. And so the key motivation for this project and what they came to us first of all with was the question, does a smaller head size matter? So if you take, this is growth data from several thousand infants. You can't see the scale very well. This is naught, half a year, 1 year, up to 2.5 years. And what you really see is that growth sort of maintains some stability in the first 6 months of life, which they think is associated with the fact that it's still exclusive breastfeeding. And then as soon as you start weaning and adding in other diet, it starts to drop off dramatically. And so by the first and second year, they're all below what you would call a typical head size, which would be a straight line across the top of this graph. So even if they're not very undernourished, they are all different from a WHO standard. And so what they were asking is, how does this change in head size relate to brain development? You know, does it matter, or are they just having smaller bodies in general to cope with the change environment, or does it mean something about the brain as well? And we came in, you know, they asked us, can we use FNIRS to answer these questions in the Gambia? So this cross-disciplinary research team was established in the first phase of our project, and this is prior to this involvement. So it was Birkbeck, UCL, and the MRC International Nutrition Group, which is between the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine in London and the Gambia Centre there. And the people involved cover all of these areas of research, and I will show you all of the names at the end because they've become very large. And to do this initial study, it was with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation funding, which is a sort of pilot fund that you can get to go out and try something bold and innovative and different. It's a 2-page anonymous application, so anyone can try. And if you get it, you are then eligible to apply for $1 million. So you can then go to the next round. So this is just on the first round, which with exchange rates was about £30,000-£40,000. It was meant to be $100,000, but it was appalling at the time in 2011. So we didn't get much money. So phase one, the goals were to transport FNIRS to the Gambia and set it up at this rural field station, to conduct a UK study with known brain responses that I'd been doing in my PhD in the Gambia setting. So that focused initially on the 4 to 6 months that I had done my whole PhD with, and then extend the study to test infants over the first 2 years of life, because the critical period for development and the impact of undernutrition is from 0 to 2 years. So just because I'm not sure how much people know about FNIRS, I'm just going to quickly say what this technique is. So FNIRS was actually something that a physicist kind of discovered or realised, I suppose, at Christmas with his family, and asked his son to clean the bone of the roast that he was eating and held it up to the light and realised that he could discern his hand straight through the bone out the other side of the meat joint. And what he thought was, if that means that you can push light through that bone and see to the other side, can you use light in the brain to see through the skull and see what's going on in the brain itself? And so the way that, oh, sorry, I was just going to say as well in that picture, if you see this photo of the hand, what you might be able to see there is you can see the capillaries and the veins and the skin, but you can't see the bones. So near infrared light goes straight through the bone. It's a different wavelength. And so the technique is just on a very simple headband or cap with fibres coming out of this, and you pair things together that are source lights and detectors. And in contrast to EEG, you'll be able to say exactly what's happening between one source and one detector, because the light that comes back to the detector that you're reading is approximately halfway between the two sensors that you have. And so what you're doing is the brain will have neuronal activation whenever it fires, and this is what we're measuring with EEG. There'll be an increase in oxygen consumption in that region as the brain is working hard and using energy. Then you'll increase oxygen delivery to meet that demand and go to that area. You'll get an increase in blood flow, and then an increase in oxyhemoglobin, and deoxyhemoglobin will go down. And this is the essence of fMRI as well. fMRI largely measures this deoxy chain, so it actually measures a loss of oxygen instead of the oxygen going in, because that's what's sensitive to the magnet that you use in MRI, whereas an ears can actually measure both of these signals. And just as a comparison, the advantages of using fNIRS with infants, therefore, is that you'll get slightly better spatial localization than EEG, so you're able to say more precisely where you think that response is. And it's much easier to use than MRI. You don't have to get them to sit still, lie still, be asleep in a scanner. So it's much more flexible for use with infants, and they can be moving around and doing what they like. And it is relatively low cost as well compared to those kind of studies. And so this is the paradigm that I used in the UK first, that we then used in that study for the first time. And so it's just a very simple set of videos where someone plays peekaboo or incy wincy spider, moves their eyes or mouth. It's silent, the video, but over the top of the video we play some sounds which are either vocal sounds or non-vocal sounds. So the vocal would be emotional, so laughter, crying, or simple yawning or coughing. And then the non-vocal sounds would just be something that the babies would be used to, like water running, or a kind of rattle type noise, which obviously they're less familiar with in the Gambia, but which they're used to in the UK. And then what you're doing in NIRS is you're always looking at activation in the experimental condition that you're interested in, and you compare that to a baseline, because you can't just ask babies to sit completely still. So you tend to put something in between that you don't believe will activate that region of the brain. Okay, so I just want to use this as an example of how versatile the technique of fNIRS is as well. This is our first morning on the site in this first study. We had it all in boxes at 11:30, unpacked it within an hour, had explained to a field worker what the study was so that he could then translate it to a mother that we got from the clinic, the lady from Senegal. Ran the study. The study takes about 5 minutes before the babies get bored, because they're not stupid, it repeats. So in the end, they're going to just say, I don't want to watch that anymore. And then voila, at the end, we think this is the first baby in Africa to have a neuroimaging study. So we haven't found anyone else that's done this yet. And then just to sort of talk about how quickly you can look at that data as well, we had a seminar the same afternoon at 3 o'clock, and I managed to analyse the data from that baby so that I could see individual responses within the infant. And actually, we can run statistical analyses on an individual as well. And the orange boxes just show you where the significant effects were. And this is exactly where I would have seen the significant effects in the UK. So this is a sort of array that runs across their head. This is the frontal cortex. And this is posterior temporal TPJ region, which is where I'd expect a social brain response to be to this type of stimuli. And so I just want to highlight that as well as being a way in which you see individual measures really well. And this is based on, you know, sometimes as little as 3 trials. So you don't have to repeat too many to get a robust signal within an individual. And just to show you an example of this, so the very high-tech lab we have here, we had a shaving mirror so that we could record what they were seeing. So this is a person doing incy wincy spider and then moving her hands up, which is why he points to his nose, because he's trying to copy. Then there's a picture of a radio, plastic chair, mosque, radio again, well, and then there's a man this time playing peekaboo. And these are the environmental sounds that he hears as well. So this was lovely for me to see as well, because I'd only ever used this task with 5-month-olds. So they smile and they coo, but I had never seen them try and copy the actions. So it was great. This boy's about 22 months. He's nearly 2. That's him, yeah, trying to copy incy wincy spider again. So it should be said as well, this may have been one of only a handful of times this boy's ever seen a television, so they don't have them in the home. So, you know, that there's that kind of thing to take into account. And so this, I just wanted to show you how we got the data that we did in this first phase before talking about the main project that we're doing. So that you can see the kind of scope of what we can measure and how we want to expand this to a wider area. So we measured across these ages. So if you take note of the colours of the ages here, And this figure just shows you where you see statistically significant effects within those groups. And so what's really lovely to see here is that there was one channel which showed a statistical effect across all of the groups of infants. The 0 to 2 month olds were asleep, so they didn't see anything, so they didn't have this visual contrast. But for all of those that were watching, they had this significant effect in the STS-TPJ region. And then when we look at these auditory sounds and compare directly something that's human and vocal to the non-human sounds, we also have a very centralised, sort of localised area of activation across the three older babies in this more anterior temporal auditory area. And that's the same as you would see in adults. And then in the younger age groups, interestingly, we see more response to the non-social sounds, so the non-human sounds, relative to the human sounds. And so I'll come back to that in a second on a slide. And just as something that you can then take from this data as well, it just shows the power of longitudinal analyses, because within those five groups of babies, these three we saw again and again and again. So we followed those each time we visited the Gambia. And we started with about 42 infants. We had three die in the 5 months that we did it, which really demonstrates how difficult it is living there. But we only lost one because the mum moved away. So the groups are nearly the same, around 40. But what you can see, interestingly, with the time courses, when we start to look in more detail, is that the younger age, going forward into the older age, the response seems to get faster as well. This is just something that we might be able to take forward as a kind of risk marker that we want to have a look at. And then this developmental specialisation across this first year in the auditory response is a lovely demonstration of something that we can now look at in a larger cohort, because we see this sort of switch between 4 and 8 months where they start to respond more to human sounds relative to non-human sounds in this paradigm. And this is something that we found consistently in other UK groups as well, where I happen to have been testing the age where it seems to be switching, because sometimes I get a big response, sometimes I get the opposite, sometimes I get both. So we will keep our eye on this. And just to bring this back to another example, in the autism study that we've been running, when we've run this task, this is just an example from the visual condition, but we actually get similar effects in the auditory. What we found is if we test infants at this same age at 5 months, we go back and see them again at 3 years and find out which ones ended up having autism and which didn't. And then we replot their data according to those with autism. What we see is a very different response in those that developed autism in this task compared to the low-risk ones or the other siblings. So these would also have brothers and sisters with autism, so they'd be at higher risk, but they didn't go on to develop autism, so they seem to fall somewhere in the middle. So this just demonstrates the power of using something like neuroimaging, you know, very much earlier than you'd be able to diagnose with behaviour, and you can see something with just a few months of life. And so what we then moved on to, as you can probably guess, we managed to get the second phase of funding, and we've recently got some additional funding as well, because I want to do more things in this project, as I'll explain at the end. And so what we're doing now is going back to the Gambia and studying in Cambridge, actually, for the last 2 years, to have a UK cohort, because we don't actually have these longitudinal data sets in any UK, well, any world population, actually. So there is not much longitudinal data. That's something about developmental research that we've been talking about over the last 2 days. It's very important to do, but very difficult to get funding for, to follow babies over time, I think, as well. And so we've got 200 in the Gambia this time, because we want to try and be able to piece apart those who have severe undernutrition and those only with mild undernutrition, and try and see what varies within those groups. And so the key goals here are to establish brain function for age curves over the age that we follow them, and characterise typical and atypical developmental trajectories. And we want to understand the impact of nutritional status, as I've said, on these early life risk factors, and also how these sort of plug into other things that might be at risk in the environment. Another key goal, actually, as well, is to train local staff to conduct research themselves, rather than parachute in, do some research and leave. All of the field staff that we're training are now running it themselves, bar one person who is sort of supervising and mainly transferring data to the server and these kind of more technical computing things. But they are running MATLAB on computers, they're putting the headgear on, they're doing the Mullen assessments, you know, all the other things I'm about to describe. So they're a very, very highly skilled team who, you know, don't have masters, they don't have this kind of educational system in the Gambia, but it just shows what you can do when you're passionate about the work. And so this longitudinal GRIPE project is going to be testing at many more age points. So we follow them in pregnancy. We have some prenatal visits. Then we have a home visit at 7 to 14 days. And then 1, 5, 8, 12, 18 and 24 months, we bring them into the clinic and we do assessments similar to what I've said. And we're going to be taking into account a lot of factors in the environment, not just nutrition, in order to try and understand what's happening. And I should say, I don't particularly predict that social cognition is what will be affected by undernutrition. That's just what I knew I could get a response in. And so this time we will be taking more measures in NEARS particularly. We'll be studying memory and attention and functional connectivity as well as social cognition to try and understand if nutrition is infecting the brain in a global manner or whether there are particular local areas or regions of the brain that will be more affected than others. If you just overview these techniques that we're using, so we have home visits when they're first born. We run a neonatal assessment that's pioneered in Cambridge, really. It's a US assessment, the NBAS, but there's a big centre here in Cambridge. So we run that in birth to try and understand behaviour. We're going to be interviewing about caregiving practices and running LENA, as was discussed yesterday, in a home visit now. That's the second phase of funding that I've just got. We'll have growth measures and biological samples of blood and milk, questionnaires on the infant development and the family, and then we'll be measuring the brain with FNIRS and wireless EEG, and then running behavioural measures. We have an eye tracking battery. We do parent caregiver interaction videos as well as the home ones, and then we're running the Mullen assessment. So I've got three things just to outline here as challenges. Yep, I'm on schedule. So one of the big challenges for me is, for all of us in the project, I suppose, is that we have large data sets that we're dealing with now. So this is just one example of that social task where we now have 100 babies in these figures. We can split them by group. We could split them by nutrition in the end. But also, you know, there may be very important individual factors here that we want to relate to other individual measures. For example, if you look at the time courses and spit by UK Gambia so far. There are more in the Gambia than the UK, but it is interesting there that you have more typical responses. So in general, they're above on the positive line, as you can see, whereas they seem to be more spread in the individuals in the Gambia. So what I'd hope to do is start to try and also predict which ones look like they'd be atypical according to their responses and see if that relates to nutritional markers as we age forward. And then we face challenges in measuring behaviour in new contexts. So the Mullen scales of early learning, we had to adapt for use in the Gambia. It was very difficult to do the first time. We had an additional study in between the two projects where we ran another 126 babies to try and make sure we'd adapted it. One of the big problems was that the field workers often just asked the parent whether this was happening. So they relied on parent report, which this thing is not supposed to do. So we were trying to reduce that. But also, you know, we found these differences, and these differences may be real, but we have to take into mind that this measure may be a difference because they're performing less well at this age, or it may be less sensitive at this age to this culture and population. So we need to try and think about these kind of things. For example, they don't have tables. So if you sit them at a table and you try to get them to do some of the items in this, you know, you're changing an environment that they're not used to. But what was interesting actually is that the thing that drove the two-year difference, because it was only significant when they reached 2 years, again, this behavioural thing not coming out till two, is the language. So their language seemed to be much later in development than anything else, which is why I want to have more home environment measures incorporated into this project. So we're hoping to try and gather information about the voice around them, you know, what they're hearing, conversational turns. There are many challenges with using LENA in that kind of environment, though, so we'll have to see how this goes, and that's why we need interviews and videos as well, I think. And so the long-term goals of Bright, you know, when we've got to that point where we're looking at this data, is to try and determine which early life risk factors associate with poorer developmental outcome. We want to identify protective factors which offer resilience against this risk, and identify which infants are most vulnerable. And then this will help us to develop low-cost, scalable and preventative treatments and test effects of different intervention strategies. So there's, you know, a lot of people are thinking now, instead of just nutritional supplementation, what about parenting strategies to sort of help in that environment? Will this scaffold development instead? And this isn't to say these parents are doing the wrong thing. They're subsistence farmers. They rely on growing their food to eat their food. They don't make any additional money. They don't have leisure time. So, you know, there's not a focus on spending time with that baby when you've got to do all the farming and collect the water and cook the meals. Not sure what the men do, but that's what the women do. And so, you know, maybe we could get the men to hang out with the babies more. That would be helpful. But yeah, it's that, you know, it's bringing all of those things into your daily life and trying to prioritise each and every one of them. And we, you know, we want to try and focus on infant brain development to improve global mental health, rather than these big, big studies that go on thousands of people tested, but they tend to sort of look at school attainment later on, and they don't think about what is happening in infancy and whether that's important. So, you know, this project is very long, and it's a lot of time points, it's a lot of commitments for parents, so we're deeply indebted to all of the families that are doing this study in and around Cambridge. They obviously have a lot more to say in Cambridge than they do in Kenneborough about whether they want to do this or not, so, you know, we have lots of strategies to try and keep everybody in the study. So far no one's dropped out after a year and a half, so that's good. And then, as I said before, this is the whole team of people associated with the Bright project. So Claire Elwell, who's a physicist at UCL, was actually the PI on the main project. I'm leading the paradigm development and the psychology, neuroscience side of it. And there's many students and postdocs at my lab. And then Sophie Moore is really leading the nutrition side of this project. She was at the MRC Human Nutrition Research Centre, which has now changed in Cambridge. And she's now in King's as well. And then there's a whole team of people. This is just some of the main names, but I think there's 15 to 20 people working on this project in the Gambia now. And then Toppen Austin is a neonatologist at the Rosie, who's helped us get that project off and running there. And Michelle Dehan is supervising the EG. So the project needs a lot of people to keep it going. Okay, thanks for listening.
Wow, thank you so much, Sarah, for that exceptional and really, really groundbreaking, world-leading research. I'm sure you're bubbling with questions, but I'm just going to jump in before you get started. So as you know, I'm really interested in social cognition and development in infants. So can you just give us a brief overview of how the home social environment in Gambia might be different from that in the UK? So for example, is there infant-directed speech? What does it sound like? How much eye contact do these babies get? We saw some of your babies imitating and see what you spotted. Do they get these nursery rhymes and action games when they're young?
So the environment's different in many ways, and I'm trying to record as much as I can, hence the extra bit of money to try and do some more home recordings. So they would live in a compound of small houses around a central yard. It's a polygamous society, so the husband may have one wife or three wives. And so you've got a lot of adults in that compound as well. The person I was working with in the first project had 21 children, enough for a football team almost, as he put it. He needed one more between the three wives. The wives will be dominant or subordinate as well, so the older one tends to get more resources than the youngest one, so that affects what kind of food they're having. And then they will, you know, with all of these brothers and sisters, as I said, the women are the farmers. They have to go out and do the farming in the wet seasons. The dry seasons, they have more availability to look after their children. In the wet season, though, grandmothers, sisters, aunties, brothers, well, less brothers, but sisters and brothers, they do it, though, the brothers, would be looking after the baby. So if they're young, they might carry them around on their back all day. If they're older, they'll probably sit them in the compound. And so I think it depends who that person is, and that's the difficulty. So when we're doing the videos, of the parent-infant interaction. We have noticed some things that are a bit different that we want to see if it carries on. So, you know, it's difficult to talk to a baby when it's 1 month old. I think people in the UK find that hard too, but they tend to know what to do, if that makes sense. You know, we push it in their face so much in media. We have all these books that tells you that you have to talk to your baby. And that really wasn't what people did 60 years ago here either, but it is something that we do more now. And it is important, as we know, to have this face-to-face interaction for language. And so that could be an easy way in which you try and get parents to do this more there. And they have book reading schemes that just get parents also to understand that their baby knows a lot more than they realise. And some of the NBAS training, we interview parents to get them to tell us what they think their baby knows and what they're interested in. And they were very similar things to us, but they just may not have as much time to do it, I suppose. And then there is a difficulty that there is a spiritual belief in Senegal more, so in some of the tribes, this is seven tribes in the Gambia, in Senegal, that you have these jinn spirits that can enter a baby if the mother looks at the baby, and then that can bring bad luck to the family or the village, and so they euthanize the babies, they leave them out to die sometimes. And so I don't think that that exists in Mandinka, which is the tribe that we have, and I don't think it exists in the Gambia. But there are sort of suggestions, perhaps, you know, that this eye contact isn't as important, and it's not something that's needed yet, and it may, you know, stem from those kind of beliefs as well. So it's tricky.
Super interesting. We definitely have to continue this over coffee. And doing a sibling study must be really effective if they've got 20 siblings in one family.
Yes, it would be very good.
Okay, let's throw the questions out to the audience. Anyone else? If you want to use a mic, I'll give that to you.
Who's asking?
Kylie.
Thank you, that was fascinating. I've just had a question about, I'm interested in how you measure nutrition levels. I imagine it must be largely parent reported, given that you can't go and watch what everybody eats. But also the differences between nutrition levels in the Gambia and in the UK, mm-hmm. whether it's possible to assess those on one single scale, whether there's overlap, whether they're so completely different, both in terms of nutrition levels and in terms of the diet that they eat. How do you kind of bridge that gap?
So with the UK and the Gambia, I treat them as two separate studies. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to be comparing them together and saying, why is this one not similar to this one? We would be looking within the Gambia over the group rather than comparing with the UK. But I think because we have so little UK data, we need that too, to just talk about development here. So we have different kinds of ways of measuring nutrition in the UK. The parents fill out food diaries once the baby starts weaning. They have to keep every single piece of food for a week that the baby's eaten as well, so that they can check exactly what was in that food. In the Gambia, in our study, we would be, in both sites, that we'd then measure physical growth, so head, leg, arm, etc. And in the in the Gambia, it depends on the study, but we would be taking blood samples to measure immune responses in the blood to sort of infection, to kind of associate that with nutrition, and asking them what they're eating, checking when they're breastfeeding. But there are other studies in the Gambia where they do exactly what you just said. They go to the home for every single meal, and they record how much food that baby eats. And what goes into that food, and they sit there and they watch what happens, and they follow them and measure their weight, height, urine, blood samples every other day for 3 years. So there are some really complex studies going on. We're not doing that in this one because we're already asking so many things. So it's sort of building up the pattern between different studies as well, I think. You're done?
One more question, we still have time, I think.
Yes, Claire, of course.
Thank you, Sarah, for a really fascinating talk. I really enjoyed it. I was thinking about the point you made about whether the Mullen was directly, you know, the extent to which it's culture fair, because until you have done it a lot, you don't know, do you? Mm. And it made me think of a talk I heard Suzanne Zadig give about infant self-recognition. Mm-hmm. So the Rouge test that we would usually use. Children in Africa tend to be very delayed on that, but if you use an alternative self-recognition test, which is self as obstacle, so recognizing that
you know those little push things that toddlers have when they're first learning to walk?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you put a plastic sheet behind that and stand the baby on it, when they try and push, they don't get anywhere because they're actually blocking their own path.
Mm-hmm.
And African babies did better than British babies on that task.
Mm-hmm.
And they were relating it to the way in which in the West we might treat an infant as an independent agent and watch them, and they get, look at me, that sort of thing is more normal for them, whereas in Africa, co-completing tasks would be much more a common way of interacting, and so understanding how you might be in somebody's way would be an earlier thing. And I wondered whether you'd used a similar approach. And
I mean, with the Malin, because, so it's difficult, lots of projects use the Bailey, some, you know, not so many use Malin, but it's the same thing really, it's a developmental scale with these measures. We just try to get it to work in that context, because we wanted to have one thing that was something that was similar to elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Other measures are completely different. So if we're measuring what they have in the home for play, it's not about, you know, do you have a toy that lights up? It's about, do you turn a saucepan into a drum or something? So it's, you know, the things that are relevant for that context. With the Malin, you know, we were comparing to a US standard, and we would hope by the end we have norms within the Gambia, in a sense, that we could compare it to as well. But yeah, I mean, it's a challenge to know what to do. I thought perhaps their fine motor skills looked like they were better in the first phase of the project. You know, and it may be because they're holding on to their mum the whole time when they're being carried, and maybe they're using their hands more. So there may be other things that are better. They feel like they're sitting up more at the moment in the five-month-olds than they would have expected. So, you know, it's just, it may be other things that they do better, as you say, than those. But yeah, it's just trying to have something that's standard as well as things that we change in what we're measuring.
The mirror would be a problem though, because we can't use it in the video anymore, because now the mums look at the video anyway, but now the babies are looking at the video now that they're 8 months. Fantastic. Let's thank Sarah very much once more.